This is VOA News. I'm Faith Lapidus. Donald Trump is on his way home after becoming the first sitting U.S. president to visit North Korea. He stepped across the border during a meeting Sunday with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. VOA's Bill Gallo says this was supposed to be a simple handshake.
Trump had said that this meeting was going to last 2 minutes. However, after meeting and Donald Trump stepped into North Korea, Kim Jong-un came over to the South Korean side. The two leaders went inside and held talks for about 50 minutes. This basically turned into an impromptu summit.
And Gallo says that South Korean President Moon Jae-in praised Trump's effort.
This is his main policy priority, is engagement with North Korea. And I can say in a less analytical mode even, this is a big priority for many Koreans here in South Korea where I'm at.
Later on Twitter, Trump referred to his meeting with Kim as wonderful and said standing on the soil of North Korea was a great honor. White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow said Sunday, resumption of trade talks between the U.S. and China is a very big deal, but acknowledged there is no immediate prospect for a deal between the world's two largest economies. He said negotiators had reached agreement on 90% of a new deal by early May, before talks broke down in what's turned out to be a 7-week stalemate. U.S. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping agreed Saturday on the sidelines of the Group of 20 Economic Summit in Japan to restart negotiations. But Kudlow assessed that the last 10% could be the toughest, with such unresolved issues as cyber attacks, mandatory technology transfer, and security concerns about Chinese multinational tech giant Huawei. This is VOA News. Tens of thousands of protesters rallied across Sudan on Sunday against the ruling generals, calling for a civilian government nearly 3 months after the army forced out long-ruling autocrat Omar al-Bashir. The mass protests centered in the capital Khartoum were the first since the deadly crackdown on June 3rd, when security forces violently broke up a protest camp. Sunday's demonstrators gathered at several points across Khartoum and the sister city of Orduman, then marched to the homes of those killed in previous protests. There were also rallies by Sudanese citizens and supporters in dozens of cities around the world over the weekend to show solidarity with the protesters. The international effort was organized online with the hashtag Blue for Sudan, encouraging people to wear blue to show their support for efforts to return Sudan to civilian rule. The Taliban and the United States are both said to be making serious efforts to conclude a draft text that could lay the groundwork for a political settlement to the 18-year-long war in Afghanistan. This is the 7th round of talks in nearly a year of negotiations. The discussions in Qatar to hammer out the deal continued uninterrupted for almost 12 hours on the opening day of Saturday, according to the spokesman for the Taliban's negotiating team. He told VOA on Sunday that the discussions are expected to continue into the next several days. The International Organization for Migration says more than 32,000 migrants worldwide have died or gone missing between 2014 and 2018. But as Lisa Schlein reports for VOA, the global figures underestimate the true nature and extent of the problem, as many migrant deaths are never reported.
The UN Migration Agency says its statistics paint a very grim picture of the perils awaiting the hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants risking their lives in search of protection or a better life. The report shows nearly 18,000 people have died or gone missing in the Mediterranean between 2014 and 2018. It says the remains of almost two-thirds of those victims have not been found. Rohingya refugees comprise the vast majority of the 2,200 deaths recorded in Southeast Asia, and most of the 288 deaths recorded in South Asia since 2014 were of Afghan migrants. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Albanians headed to the polls Sunday amid high tensions between the ruling and opposition parties and a tug of war between the country's prime minister and the president. The main opposition parties boycotted the municipal elections, accusing the socialist-led government of election fraud and corruption. Prime Minister Edi Rama and his government have denied the allegations and insisted on holding the vote. President Ilir Meta said he'd postpone it. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
You are using other traditional ways of communication to inform the audience and the public about the new organizing activities and about the new steps that we are going to do if TMC does not respond completely to their demands.
Tens of thousands of Sudanese demonstrators protest against civilian rule Sunday.
That if there is a change of leadership at the top, people think, are more likely to think that elections were free and fair. And if they think elections were free and fair, they are more likely to support elections as the best method of choosing leaders.
A new survey shows a majority of Africans support democratic elections.
By and large, what we've tried to do is to work very hard to ensure working with international partners, because negotiating with terrorists is never, you know, it's not a government to terrorist thing. We work with foreign governments. We work with the International Red Cross and several other organizations.
And Nigerian Vice President Yemi Osinbajo says the administration in Abuja is committed to resolving the ongoing security challenges. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Tens of thousands of Sudanese protesters gathered in the capital Khartoum to pressure the Transitional Military Council, or TMC, to hand over power to a civilian-led government Sunday. Dubbed the Million Man March, the Sudanese Professional Association said the protest is aimed to recognize those who died in the struggle to push the former government out, as well as to mark the end of the 30-year rule of deposed President Omar Hassan al-Bashir. For more about Sunday's protest, I reach Mohammed Ali Fazari, columnist for Al Akhbar Daily, a major Arabic newspaper in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
The people were walking along the distance from about 10 kilometers from the city of Durman, the city of Khartoum, and around the outskirts of these two cities, and chanting, and the police in some areas, but not all of them, dispersed the protesters by using tear gas. But as the number was increasing and the number became very huge, the police stopped throwing tear gas on the demonstration and the protest. So this day has two signals. The one of them is that is the martyrs and the commemoration of these martyrs, and also the 30 years rule of the former ousted President al-Bashir. So right now the police is using little force than ever before. We witnessed in the previous protest using live ammunition and also using excessive force, but this time we didn't find this. I think this is due to the warning from international organization and human rights activists, and also Troika yesterday issued a statement warning the TMC that using excessive force is not allowed, and also they have zero tolerance in using such kind of forces against the peaceful protesters in Khartoum.
Earlier on, the TMC warned the organizers of the protest they will shoulder the blame or responsibility if any of these protesters were to lose their lives. What happened to that threat?
The Sudanese Professional Association has refuted such allegation yesterday, and they held a press conference and said that we don't have weapons, we don't have guns. Those who use weapons and use guns, their responsibility is to protect the peaceful protesters, not we are as a civilian, they said in the press conference and a press statement. Also, they threw the ball into the square of TMC and hold it the responsibility of the peaceful life of the people. They said also condemned the harassment and the crackdown on press freedom. As you know, yesterday, security forces stopped a press conference to be held in the Sudanese professional unions in Khartoum and other outskirts of Khartoum.
Are they going to continue organizing regular protests to pressure the administration, the TMC, to hand over power quickly? Because recently, the TMC just accepted a proposal by the African Union about the transitional process.
As you know, Mr. Peter, that is Professional Union Association, SPA, is the key body of that organized protest. Every beginning of the week, they spread what they call a schedule for revolutionary activities. This is started from Sunday up to Thursday. They are also giving specific activities, a specific time for all the protesters, what are going to do, what's going to happen. And they are also said they are going to organize many forums and workshops, and they are going to speak to the people on the gathering places, in the markets, in the streets, in any public places. They said that we have a revolutionary schedule to be published on their website. And also, as you know, in Sudan these days, internet is blocked out here, but they are going to use SMS message and through posters, and they are using other traditional ways of communication to inform the audience and the public about the new organizing activities and about the new steps that they are going to do if TMC does not respond completely to their demands.
What has been the response of the TMC following Sunday's protest by the Sudanese Professional Association and their demand for the immediate handover to a civilian regime?
TMC still says that it's adhered to the agreement, which is an initiative of the Ethiopian and African Union, and they said that he's waiting for SPA and FFC to just hand over the names of the member of the government that is just in the presidential president or regarding the cabinet of ministers, so that to start very soon organizing and forming the government. And as you know, that in the Ethiopian initiative, they delayed discussing the legislative council till further notice. And this is the issue which SPA rejected. And he said everything should be started from all the three levels of the government, means that is the presidential council and a council of ministers and the legislative council.
Mohamed Ali Fazari is a columnist for Al Bak Daily, a major Sudanese Arabic newspaper. He spoke with me from Khartoum. Survey shows that a majority of Africans support democratic elections if the outcome leads to a change in leadership. Afrobarometer is a non-partisan research network that conducts public attitude surveys on democracy, governance, economic conditions, and related issues on Africa. For more on the survey, I reach Michael Barton, a senior advisor at the organization.
In the latest Afrobarometer poll, which considers public opinion up to the end of 2018 in about three dozen countries, three quarters of the respondents we spoke to said that they thought that open, regular, and fair elections were the best way to select leaders. They preferred elections to any other method. Now, possibly they might be thinking of elections that are controlled by a dominant party. So in order to check for that, we also asked people whether they thought that multi-party competition was necessary. And again, about two-thirds of the respondents said that it was necessary to have multiple parties so that they had a choice at the ballot box. So when they're saying they prefer elections, what they're saying is they prefer regular, open, and fair elections.
But I also understand that surprisingly, opposition party supporters are likely, as the ruling party supporters, to see election as free and fair. However, non-partisans are far less likely to have the same perception about the integrity of the election. Talk to me about this.
Yes, you have it absolutely right, Peter, and it is a surprising result. Let's just take a step back here and take the big picture view and ask how Africans see the quality of their elections. Well, about 80% think that they are at least reasonably free and fair, which I think is a good sign. It may be an overly generous interpretation, but it is roughly consistent with what expert opinion is also saying. To go back to this issue of partisanship, I think we would expect that supporters of the ruling parties would be much more satisfied with the quality of elections than the losing opposition. But in fact, there's very little difference between supporters of ruling parties and supporters of opposition parties when they come to assess the integrity of elections. I take this as a really quite positive sign in that it is necessary for the losers to give consent in order for a democratic system to function properly. The fact that the opposition hasn't given up on elections just because they lose, I think, indicates that there's still some steam left in the democratic transformation that has occurred in Africa since 1990.
Well, but Michael, I also understand that citizens in some of these respective countries that you polled seem to suggest that they prefer to see ruling party lose to an opposition candidate, then they attach much importance and integrity of the elections, evidence that the election was free, fair, transparent, and credible if power switches hand from the ruling party to the opposition party. Is this what found in your recent polling?
You've obviously read the report very closely, Peter. In order to explain why Africans support open elections, we find that one of the key factors is whether they think that the last election was indeed free and fair. If not completely free and fair, at least free and fair with minor problems. But in order to determine whether they think it's free and fair, we find that the best explanation we can discover in the data is that that previous election led to an alternation of top leaders. That is, there's been a political turnover of ruling parties and an opposition leader has come in. So that the causal sequence seems to go like this, that if there is a change of leadership at the top, people think are more likely to think that elections were free and fair. And if they think elections were free and fair, they are more likely to support elections as the best method of choosing leaders.
Michael Barton is a senior advisor at Afrobarometer. He spoke with me from New York.
Nigerian Vice President Yemi Osinbajo says President Muhammadu Buhari's administration will not be deterred in its commitment to resolve the country's security challenges. His remarks follow criticisms that the government has failed to combat kidnappings and violence carried out by militants. In part two of our interview, Vice President Yemi Osinbajo responds to reports of growing insecurity in several parts of Nigeria.
Mr. Vespa, how do you respond to those who said there has been a sharp increase in kidnappings? They cite examples of the Dapchi girls and the Chibok girls who have yet to be all brought home to their parents. What do you say to that?
Well, let's start with the Chibok girls. Of course, you know the Chibok girls were kidnapped in 2014. You know, we got into power in 2015. We negotiated the release of the Chibok girls. So far, about 107 of them are back, and we're still in the process, practically on a daily basis, of trying to get them back. We responded as promptly as we could to the kidnap of the Dapchi girls in Yobe State. Unfortunately, five of them did not come back. Four died, and one of them, Leah Shaibu, remains in captivity. So really, as a government, you know, what we want to do is to make sure that all our citizens are safe everywhere they are. Now, what the plan of the terrorist is to ensure that that is not the case. So it's a constant battle between us and terrorists. And this is what happens in many other parts of the world, where you have kidnappings or abductions by terrorists and all of that. But I think that, by and large, what we've tried to do is to work very hard to ensure, working with international partners, because negotiating with terrorists is never, you know, it's not a government to terrorist thing. We work with foreign governments, we work with the International Red Cross and several other organizations that help in that whole process of trying to negotiate the return either of the Chibok girls or the Dapchi girls, and in particular Leah Shaibu, who remains in captivity.
So how do you intend to improve the living conditions of Nigerians? Some people are saying the situation is difficult. How would your government help to jumpstart the economy, improve lives, combat corruption? How would your government do this to improve the living conditions of Nigerians?
I think the major challenge for us, and I'm sure with many developing economies, is that of poverty. In our case, I mean, 2012 figures show, for instance, that over 100 million Nigerians were living in extreme poverty. The question, of course, is, or the problem, of course, is that problem of poverty was never systematically addressed. You know, and so when we came in 2015, we decided on implementing a social investment policy, a social investment program, possibly the largest of its kind anywhere in Africa, where we budgeted a sum of 500 billion, you know, to address this question. Now, how we wanted to approach that and how we've approached it is, first of all, to try and create some kind of a safety net of sorts. But we didn't want to do that by just gifts of any kind, you know. So we did that by granting microcredit loans to the bottom of the pyramid. Working with the Bank of Industry, we targeted 2 million petty traders across the country whose inventories are usually not more than about 3,000 naira. And we decided that we'll give them the sum of 10,000 naira to improve their inventories. And then when they pay back, they get 15,000, and they pay back 20,000, all the way up to 100,000. We found that that was an effective way of empowering our people, empowering the informal trader, who form the largest number of those who are working, but who at the same time are considered risky for any kind of credit facility. It was also an important way of bringing them into the financial net, and so that in a more formalized system where we're able to train them, where we're able to open bank accounts for them and all of that. The second thing we did was what was called the homegrown school feeding, which is a program where we feed children in public primary schools, you know, every day. At the moment, we're doing about 9.5 million children in 31 states of our 36 states. It's an important program for us, first because it addresses questions of malnutrition, and we know that malnutrition is a major cause of mental stunting, which is a permanent and irreversible condition. So we work on that, and of course it affects largely poor people, you know, and many of the kids in public primary schools are of course children of the poor. So by and large, you know, that's one of the things. And then, of course, we also address unemployment with our what we call the Empower Program.
Yemi Osinbajo is the Nigerian Vice President. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Dr. Alexander Enim-Mensah is an inventor who was recently recognized in the United States with a Distinguished Patent Fellow Award for his innovative ideas. He has about 30 registered patents to his name. He says African countries can reap huge benefits if they diligently pursue innovation, inventions, and patents. To learn more about his work, I reached Dr. Enim-Mensah by phone in Columbus, Ohio.
The good news here is so many people have innovation, but you are only recognized as a distinguished innovator only when your patent or idea goes into a product and is making over $10 million. So that made me being recognized alongside with others as a distinguished innovator.
Looking at the recognition, you've been traveling across Africa. You have concerns about some of the things happening. What have you seen in Africa that you think can be improved?
One thing I've realized is that we will say we don't have money, and we will say when we put money into something, we want quick return. But this innovation process requires money, and it requires patience, and it requires that it should be done very well with the right people, and we'll have the right gains from it. But it seems it's not pursued very well, and we think we are not capable. I mean, the word inventor or invention, it feels in Africa, it feels like a distant word in Africa. But we are always inventing every day unknowingly. But the sad part is, whatever we come out with, it doesn't get to the world scene for us to make enough money from that. I will cite a simple example. Edinkra Sambos, Kente, have been in existence for a long time. But I've seen people have Edinkra Sambos who are not from Africa or even Ghana on their T-shirt and the rest. So the question becomes, I mean, are these symbols protected?
Looking at some of these issues that you've identified and clearly enumerated, what steps can be taken by institutions, including the government, to help in this directive? Because, as you say, people are brimming with ideas, ideas that, if adopted properly with pragmatic steps, could solve the enormous challenges these countries on the continent face.
Let me talk about one problem, and I'll look at it from a different angle. I'm thinking that ECOWAS is a big body, which is across West Africa, for instance. So if ECOWAS is able to come out with a strong system, which is tied to the ECOWAS states, it will be a very good way to go about it. First, there should be a way to gather those information in terms of if anybody has a new idea, the person should write on a paper and go straight to an office somewhere and then document his or her name and say that I was the person who came up with the idea. That's the first to file, right? This currently is first to file. There need to be a way of letting people know of this invention process so that if anything, depending on where they have a small office to report, and we can say that this person filed here or there, and then people should be aware not to share ideas easily if they have any information which is going to help. The next thing is to having a very good institution where people can disseminate information, and those institutions should keep those information as secret as possible. In Africa, people do funny stuff. Someone come and register the information, they can pick the information and give to someone to pursue it, right? But at the end of the day, whoever comes up with that decision or the idea need to be part of the process because the person came up with the idea. Another thing is having a robust requirement. Coming out with an idea, it doesn't just come out of the blue. Idea comes when you see a problem, right? The question is, are we trying to project Africa or Ghana on the global level? Are we looking to project Ghana or Africa on the regional level? Whatever levels it is, what is the problem? It's the problem that people have to look at it and then come up with ideas, and then we take them through a rigorous process.
Dr. Alexander Enim Mensah is an inventor. He spoke with me from Columbus, Ohio. A Kenyan parliamentarian is coming under criticism after reportedly making xenophobic attacks against foreigners. Charles Njagua, who was arrested following his remarks, faces charges of inciting voters against foreigners. A judge has since directed him to be held at the police station until Tuesday. For VOA, Mokbil Yabro has more.
The talk about xenophobia has been echoing in the streets of Nairobi since last week, when a Kenyan MP said he would beat up foreign traders if they did not leave the country. Charles Njugua Kanye said in a video that Tanzanian and Ugandan traders were taking Kenyan businesses and enough is enough. Mr. Kanye's remarks triggered a diplomatic row and Tanzanian Prime Minister summoned the Kenyan High Commissioner for an explanation. Kenya is East Africa's economic hub, attracting people from across the region to move there to make money. So such remarks could affect the foreign business in Kenya. Omar Ahmed is a businessman in Nairobi's Eastleigh business hub. He believes such remarks would only discourage the foreign business community in Kenya.
His idea was not good for business because the business cannot take that environment. It was very unprofessional. It was uncalled.
MP Richard Onyoka believes that MP Njagua's comments hurt the global perception of the Kenyan business community.
The truth is xenophobia is something that we are dealing with, I think, globally. But in Africa, it has been a big problem in South Africa. And it now looks like Kenya is going to be another country that may be considered to be a xenophobic country.
Ali Khan Sachu, a Kenyan business analyst, says such remarks have no place in the Kenyan business community, and it would not be good for any party involved.
No, absolutely not. I think the East African community actually has been the best performing bloc inside the African continent. And it would be very unfortunate to lose those gains because of this friction, loose talk. But nevertheless, it has been a problem, specifically between Kenya and Tanzania.
Although Mr. Kanye was arrested by plainclothes police officers outside the parliament buildings in Nairobi for his remarks, he has already changed his tone, saying his remarks were meant towards China and not towards Africans. But some analysts believe that the comments may have already affected the global perception of Kenya. Mokbil Yabro, VOA, Washington.
This is The Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Mpunga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, the mayor of Washington, D.C.'s office on African affairs, in partnership with other groups, held an African fashion show and culture expo Saturday. The event showcased and celebrated the nation's capital, African fashion, creativity and culture. Joining me live in the studio to talk about Saturday's event are Joanna LeBlanc, Commission on African Affairs, and Joyce Donko, founder of African Fashion Week DC and a partner with the Mayor's Office on African Affairs. Ladies, hello and welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. Let me come to you, Joanna. How did the event go yesterday?
The event was definitely a success. I think maybe a little bit over 250 people showed up. And what was so important about the event yesterday is that we emphasize on promoting small businesses in the community. And as we know, there is a large African community here in D.C. I think it's the second largest population of Africans in the United States, with Ethiopians leading and Nigerians second and Ghanaians third. And we know the different groups tend to be business owners. So for the Mayor's Office on African Affairs, it was important to create a platform to ensure that they receive the visibility that they deserve, and also make some money. Because at the end of the day, what is a business if you can't make money, right? So because of that, I think the event was a success. And we had hair braiders. We know we have a lot of African women in this area who braid hair, and they're extremely talented. And a lot of times they don't get the promotion that they deserve. So they were able to kind of like showcase their talent, right? And then we also had fashion show. As we know, the African fabric is booming all across the world. Everybody wants an African attire, right? An attire that is made with the African fabric. So the Mayor's Office on African Affairs partnered with Joyce, who will speak more about that, because she's the one who handled the fashion aspect of the expo.
Let me come
yesterday
to you, Joyce. Talk to me about the fashion expo. How did people respond to it, and what impact do you think that would have today and in the near future? Its prospects, basically.
Absolutely. So first I want to acknowledge the participants or the fashion designers that were part of the show, which is Obioma Fashion House of Lenoche, Keys and Credo, MOHB Couture. And they were essential in making this show a success. Their designs were great, amazing. The audience responded very well. They were very pleased. A lot of people, the models were exceptional. They were great. A lot of people stood up, clapped, and really enjoyed it. But most importantly, to piggyback off of what Joanna said, it was really important to provide the platform for these designers, because a lot of the time these designers do not have, you know, these platforms. So for the Office of African Affairs to really want to focus in on these fashion designers and call me in to assist them with that, it was amazing. And it was a process that, you know, I will always forever be grateful for, because I was able to see the importance and how effective the Office of African Affairs is in trying to make sure that they are promoting businesses in the D.C. metropolitan area.
So far, how has been your experience working with the Office of African Affairs at the Mayor's Office?
It was absolutely great. I work with Mamadou. He was the one that called me out of the blue and said, this is an idea that I'm having. I want to focus on braiders, and I want to focus on D.C. fashion, specifically D.C. Fashion designers based in the D.C. metropolitan area. And from there, we developed a team with Joanna, Jennifer, a queen, and we all work together very, very well. So I feel like they really did do a great job in ensuring that this event was a success.
Good. Joanna, let me come to you. There are sometimes speculations that the mayor's office doesn't do much for the African community. What say you about it?
Well, I would disagree for two reasons. One, there is an office called the Mayor's Office on African Affairs, right? Mm-hmm. So for a mayor to create that office says, I see the population and I see the issues, so I'm going to create an office specifically to handle the issues impacting persons of African descent in the District of Columbia. In addition to having the office, there's a commission, which is the Commission on African Affairs, and I serve as a commissioner. And it's a group of 12 people that are appointed strictly by the mayor. Again, the commission's job is to support the mayor's Office on African Affairs. So the mayor has essentially gone above and beyond to ensure that the issues of persons of African descent here in the district are not only recognized, but also she provides a platform to ensure those issues are properly addressed. So as a commissioner, and along with my amazing commissioners, our job is to advise the mayor on how to handle policy decisions when it comes to the African community. So we testify to hearings. We attend various events throughout the community. We put together events. We have town hall discussions to find out what are the issues. We invite people to our monthly meetings or bi-monthly meetings to find out how can we get the community more engaged, right? So I will completely disagree with that notion that the mayor does not support, because if she did not, you would not have an office and a commission comprised of attorneys, doctors, public servants to ensure so the commission is essentially comprised of people from the community, because all of us are DC residents.
So far, what has been the engagement with the African community and what has been the response from the African community based on the policies being implemented by the mayor strictly on African issues that she's encountered?
I think that the office, this administration has done a great job. For example, there was one particular instance where there's grant available for Africans who want to apply for their citizenship. There's funding available for the whole process to assist you with. So there are so many ways that the mayor is actually supporting her constituents. I could go on and on and on and speak, but what I can tell you as a commissioner, I didn't join the commission just so I could have a title, right? I joined the commission because of what the mandate says that we have to do. And because the mayor and the Office on African Affairs allows the commissioners to truly be the voice of the community and to work together to ensure that the problems are solved and to implement policies that will have a positive impact on the community at large.
Before we go briefly, Joyce, I come to you first before going to Joanna.
Absolutely.
What should people expect next time for this expo?
So the next expo will be held September 2019. We will have a variety of different events. So we'll obviously have a fashion show featuring DC-based designers, but not only DC-based designers, but people all over the country and abroad. We'll also have pop-up shops where people could come and shop. We'll have a panel discussion where people could come and learn about starting a business, a fashion designing business, all over the world. So there's a variety of different things to look forward to in September.
Thank you. Joanna, last a few words before we go. Expectations.
A few words. Moving forward, the commission, in conjunction with the mayor's office on African Affairs, we're looking forward to working with the community and again to find out what are the needs and what we can do to assist them. And I forgot to mention that this part earlier, that the mayor's office on African Affairs actually has grants for small businesses, for NGOs, to support them. So there are a lot of services offered by the office. So I will recommend anyone who's listening to go on the mayor's office on African Affairs website and see what the resources and what the programs are available to you as a taxpayer in the District of Columbia.
Joanna LeBlanc is the commissioner on Commission on African Affairs, and Joyce Dong, co-founder of African Fashion Week DC and a partner with the mayor's office on African Affairs. They join me live here in Washington, DC. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with the Africa Cup of Nations in Egypt. Defending champions Cameroon remain top of Group F after a goalless draw with Ghana. The five-time winners beat Ghana 2-0 in the 2017 semifinals, with four of the six third-place teams qualifying for the knockout stage. Cameroon are well-placed to reach the last 16 after starting their defense with a 2-0 win over Guinea-Bissau, while Ghana were held to a 2-2 draw with Benin in the opener. For Cameroon, with 4 points after two games, it should be enough to reach the knockout phase. Ghana have been to the quarterfinals at the past 8 Africa Cup of Nations, and now they have to depend on their final group game against Guinea-Bissau. Meanwhile, Benin kept their chances of qualifying for the last 16 alive with a goalless draw against Guinea-Bissau in Ismailia. Angola were forced to settle for a draw with Mauritania after Geraldo's 90th minute goal was disallowed. Tunisia drew 1-1 with Mali on Friday in Group E's other game. Angola now need to beat Group E leaders Mali in their final group game on Tuesday to qualify for the last 16, while Mauritania end their group campaign against Tunisia the same day. Algeria beat Senegal to clinch a place in the last 16. In Group C's other game, Kenya came from behind to beat Tanzania 3-2. The result moves Kenya level on 3 points with Senegal, who were beaten 1-0 by leaders Algeria, while Tanzania exit the tournament still searching for their first victory. Kenya play Senegal and Tanzania face Algeria in the final group games on Monday. Madagascar had their first Africa Cup of Nations win by beating Burundi. Madagascar are second in the group with 4 points after this victory and a draw against Guinea. They face Nigeria, who are top with 6 points in the final group game on Sunday. Burundi's chances of reaching the knockout stages are as good as over after suffering their second defeat in as many games in their first Africa Cup of Nations. Meanwhile, South Africa boosted their chances of reaching the last 16 by beating neighbors Namibia 1-0. South Africa will attempt to secure a place in the last 16 when they face group leaders Morocco on Monday. Namibia still have an outside chance of automatic qualification themselves, but they will need to score their first tournament goal since 2008 to beat Ivory Coast and hope group leaders Morocco beat South Africa by more than one goal. And Mohamed Salah made one and scored one as host Egypt and 7 times winners beat DR Congo 2-0 to move into the last 16. This was DR Congo's second defeat in 2 games, and they have to beat Zimbabwe on Sunday and hope they claim one of the 4 spots available to teams finishing third in their group. Egypt will go through as group winners if they avoid defeat against second-placed Uganda on Sunday. And Tunisia rescued a point against Mali in Suez as they boosted their chances of qualifying for the last 16. Tunisia play Mauritania in their final group game on Tuesday, while Mali face Angola at the same time in Ismailia. And in the Women's World Cup, 2-time champions Germany suffered a shock Women's World Cup quarterfinal exit as Sweden came from behind to beat them 2-1 in Rennes. Sweden's semi-final opponents are the Netherlands, who defeated Italy 2-0. England play the USA. Sweden and the Netherlands join Great Britain, who benefit from England's run to the last 4 in qualifying for the 2020 Olympic Games in Tokyo as the top 3 European teams at the World Cup. Germany will not get the chance to defend the gold medal they won at Rio 2016. Finally, in athletics, Kenyan long-distance runner Salome Jerome Biwott has once again been suspended for doping. The 36-year Biwott has provisionally been suspended by the Athletics Integrity Unit, having tested positive to prohibited norandrosterone. Biwott, who was first hit with a 2-year ban in 2013 when she failed a drug test after winning the 2012 Standard Chartered Nairobi Marathon, is fresh from finishing second at Sao Paulo International Marathon in 2 hours, 37 minutes and 33 seconds in April this year. She's now likely to get another 4-year ban if found guilty, 4 years after completing the other doping ban. Biwott becomes the fourth Kenyan to be suspended for doping within 2 months, after world half marathon record holder Abraham Kiptum, 2017 world champions 5,000 meters representative Cyrus Ruto and Felix Kirwa were sanctioned. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports.
Thank you.
it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. You're hearing Baraka the Prince featuring Sappy with Raha. Then we end with Yemi Alade Olamide Nyanya Techno Celebobo on Mama Oyoyo. That was our Sunday music spot. I hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The 20 most developed countries said to be in G20 have just concluded their summit meeting in Osaka, Japan. The only African country that belonged to the group is South Africa, although many Africans will wonder why, since Nigeria has a larger economy than South Africa. But maybe they're thinking more of the industrial capacity of South Africa, which is, of course, greater than that of Nigeria. This year in Osaka, the G20 states are trying to tackle the issue of world trade. Since President Trump was inaugurated, world trade has been in turmoil. He has issued unilateral sanctions and sweeping tariffs against member states. By the way, many member states of the United Nations believe that these unilateral measures and tariffs are illegal in terms of the Charter of the United Nations. Also linked to these unilateral measures is the tendency of the United States to issue what is called secondary sanctions against those members of the international community that may disagree with the U.S. sanction and have failed to comply with them. According to the United States, if you do not follow their sanctions against third party, then you become subject to their sanctions. So this is something which all states are trying to tackle. And this is the main subject that was looked at Osaka. Apart from that, there has been some problem between the United States and China because President Trump has issued many sweeping tariffs against China. And there is a few view in the international community that these have destabilized world trade. So they were waiting to see whether President Trump and President Xi will reach an agreement to be able to stabilize world trade. As far as this matter is concerned, at the end of the summit, both President Trump and President Xi announced that the stalled talks are now on track, but there have been no results in the negotiations. And in the circumstances, President Trump announced that the United States would not be issuing new tariffs on China, thus stabilizing the situation. But there are other states that are trying to find ways around President Trump's unilateral measures, usually issued without notice. For example, the European states are now trying to find a way around sanctions against Iran by using non-dollar currency. Also at Osaka, President Xi, Putin, and Xi tried to see whether they could use some barter system to get around U.S. banking system and dollar. And in a very interesting meeting between Prime Minister Modi, President Putin, and Xi, Prime Minister Modi told the colleagues that he had to issue a stiff tariff against 28 U.S. products to react against U.S. sanctions. And this would affect the album trade in California and may affect 100,000 workers. So these are the ways they are trying to see what could be done. In terms of the communique, it seems that the conseguees have agreed to try to modernize or reform WTO, although no one says whether they have consulted the developing countries in this endeavor. Also, there has been some decision on the issue of climate change because President Macron of France had said he would not sign the communique unless there's a reference to climate change. Finally, President Trump has been complaining that in previous multilateral trade agreements, the U.S. has been mistreated. No one can deny that the Africans in all of trade agreements have always had the short stick. So it is important for African policymakers to follow the nitty-gritty of these negotiations because sooner or later, these world trade issues will impact on them. And it's important for them to learn the lessons to be able to tackle an issue which will affect their people. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Saleh, Reporter Douglas Impuga, Producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Xiao Gang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, quality beads do not rattle. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Marissa Melton.